Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs in a circle of motion. Thought is like a little port of fun.
Most of us want to live a life filled with happiness, but the road isn't always easy. Do we have to figure it out the hard way? Or can scientific method reveal the path to living a life full of joy and meaning? And if so, can it be taught as a course in college? I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, The Pursuit of Happiness.
Happiness runs in a circular motion. Thought is like a little boat upon the sea. Everybody is a part of everything anyway.
Later in the show, when America began to become a consumer culture at the turn of the 20th century, the new professional advertisers didn't have much respect for the American consumer, but
they have to get these nincompoops to buy their stuff.
But first, traditional psychology has focused on controlling negative emotions or neuroses, but there's increasing interest in the sometimes controversial field of positive psychology, which investigates what it takes to make people truly happy. George Mason University professor of psychology Todd Kashtan teaches a course in positive psychology called The Science of Well-Being. Todd and his course were profiled in a recent issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Todd, before we talk about the class you teach at George Mason University, tell me about the field called positive psychology. What is it? How is it different from other research in the field of psychology?
Right. So basically, I'm a clinical psychologist. So I've been trained in the study and treatment of anxiety and mood disorders. And we have, as a discipline, psychology, we've probably mapped out how to treat about 14 different psychological disorders. But if we were hypothetically able to completely rid the world of anxiety, depression, eating disorders, substance use disorders, the world wouldn't necessarily be a happier place. The reason is that you have this sort of gray zone where people can be without disorder and not necessarily thriving. And so there's something else to human beings other than just the absence of disorders. And that's where this sort of study of the positive side of human functioning started to come into flavor, I think, in the past 10, 15 years.
So positive psychology, though, is not meant to be the treatment for someone who comes to you with depression, clinical depression.
A better way to look at positive psychology, and this is important for the skeptics who are constantly there, and they should be there because they keep us on our toes, is it's more of that if I treated someone for obsessive compulsive disorder, someone who spent 2.5 hours a day washing, cleaning, putting down newspapers to walk on to get to their car so they wouldn't get in contact with any germs. If I was to completely treat that condition, what do they do now with those 4 extra hours they now have a day if this has been a debilitating condition for 20 years of their life? How can we get your life now that you're not suffering and impaired, to being more pleasurable, engaging, and meaningful? So it's more of a supplement to add in the aftermath of treating a psychological condition.
So when you teach the course at George Mason University, The Science of Well-Being, what's your goal?
The goal of the course is really no different than any other course on science. It's to help students develop a critical examination of their everyday life and understand sort of how they can sort of examine things from a little bit of a more objective stance to determine what it is that makes things more likely to be enriching, what makes people more likely to experience positive emotions, people with certain personality traits and configurations who are more or less likely to lead fulfilling lives. So some of the traits that make you more likely to lead a fulfilling life is being high in perseverance, expressing a level of moral courage, so being able to stand up for things against sort of social norms and the majority, people who are more curious, people who are more grateful and appreciative of the little things and benefits they accrue in life. So let's take someone who's been in a romantic relationship for 25 years. You start to predict what your partner's going to say before you even say anything. So it's instead of going by scripted roles of your relationship, of maybe I'm the dominant partner, maybe my wife is sort of the submissive one when it comes to conversations. It's realizing that changes constantly. And when we throw on our templates of how people are and how our relationship is, we miss the little nuances of when they're different.
That's really wonderful. Tell me about some of the other exercises that you do in class.
half of the course is about teaching about what sort of the body of knowledge of what we learned so far about these processes. And the other half is them actually doing things in their life, what I call experiential assignments, of experimenting on themselves. So for the class on curiosity, their assignment is I want you to go out and go talk to someone you would never talk to in your sort of previously before this assignment, someone who's completely unrelated to you, not in your social sphere whatsoever. Maybe it's a blue-collar worker. Maybe it's a musclehead. Maybe it's someone with a mohawk. And I want you to strike up a conversation. If it doesn't work out for more than 5 minutes, I want you to talk to someone else who's sort of novel to your social world.
And what do they say?
Well, what happened is you had a mixed response. It was exactly what you hoped to get from a class. A lot of people said, listen, it was really eye-opening to realize that when, you know, I went to talk to someone who with a mohawk, that they were incredibly intellectually stimulating. And it was one of the best conversations I had. And they whipped out conversations about books they read, Ayn Rand, and they were talking about, you know, Kafka and sort of, and it made me realize that my stereotype going in was nothing compared to sort of what this person was really about.
You speak in the course of signature strengths. What are those?
So it's the idea that every one of us has our own little configuration or matrix of personality qualities. So for example, forgiveness, not one of my signature strengths. This is not something that's a dominant, typical behavior that I engage in. I hold grudges for years. I'm very proud of this. I'm not a very patient person by any stretch of the imagination. Anyone who works for me or has sat in on one of my classes knows that I'm not patient. Some of my strengths are I'm extremely open-minded and curious, that I happen to be extremely persevering. I will persevere at a goal until blood, sweat, and tears ooze out of every pore of my skin, until my hands are chafed and I can't even hold a pencil. So these would be sort of the defining characteristics if you were to sort of ask me, who is Todd Kasdan? When I'm acting in ways that uses those characteristics, I feel better on those days because I'm working through the things that are my best capacities. This is sort of one of the tenets that's currently being explored, is that when you do things through your dominant traits, that's potentially when you get derived the most positive experiences and the best outcomes.
What about you asking students to write letters of gratitude? What are you after there?
Well, that's probably the exercise where people in the class get the most benefits out of. And what it is really picking out a person over the course of your lifetime that you haven't properly thanked for the benefits that they've given you, and then going to them physically, ask them just to sit down and listen, and reading them the entire letter. A typical thing that happens is with men in the class is what you find is a lot of them write letters to their fathers, so they've never really had, you know, a strong emotional connection, but probably an extremely powerful bond nonetheless. And they write this letter that involves a lot of emotions, things that they never really expressed to their fathers. And a good portion of men in my classes over the years have said that it's the first time they've really hugged their father, that they've really seen their father tell them that they love them. Other people have a completely diametrical experience where they're surprised that the person they told them to sort of brushed it off and immediately almost felt obligated to tell them what they're grateful about.
There's another exercise that fascinates me that you call the one memory. What is that?
It's based on an early 1990 Japanese film called Afterlife. And in that movie is an idea of a perception of heaven. That heaven, everyone sort of when they die goes to purgatory. And they have 3 days to look through videotapes of their entire life to pick out one memory. Sort of what eternity is the reliving of a single memory. Because you have to think about it. Do you pick the most incredibly passionate experience, maybe an amazing sex, an amazing dinner, and a real intimate connection during a conversation with someone? Or do you pick someone that has as many people that you care about in your life at one time? So maybe it's that family gathering. There probably wasn't that enjoyable because people are running around with like the chickens with their heads cut off and you've got relatives complaining and kvetching and gossiping about who they hate and who doesn't call them back. Not that enjoyable potentially when it occurred, but when you think back about it, it's nice to just be there around all these people that you know care about you.
Another thing you do that is a major message of yours with the students is that there is a big difference between feeling good and doing good and how they might pursue those two different feelings.
Right. And I think that's important when people read about positive psychology and they think about happiness. And there must be about 45 books on the self-help section right now in Barnes Nobles that talk about how to be happy. Here's 5 steps. Is to think about that happiness is not a single entity. So one mode of happiness is about feeling good. It's about having a high rate of positive experiences and a low rate of negative experiences. But that's only one definition or conception of happiness. There's another one that dates back to Aristotle. It's about acting in a way that's sort of using my best capacities in the pursuit of excellence and virtue. And so when you think of Gandhi, or you think of Mother Teresa, or you think of Martin Luther King, these are people that put their lives at risk, that devoted an incredible amount of time for the greater good, the betterment of humankind. And this is very different than feeling happy and content because I've got a yacht, I have a great paying job, I have a beautiful wife and beautiful kids to look at when I come home, and things are just grand. It's a lot different in terms of what exactly you apply your efforts and energies to.
You know, that is what we all believe most of the time, but there are times when I think that guy with the yacht and the beautiful family and the disposable income is having a good time. He may never look back and say, this was rotten.
The first caveat that I give in my class every year when I teach is you will never see me denigrate sex, drugs, chocolates, exercising, or being completely selfish to just make sure that you dominate a conversation because you have an incredible story to tell and you want to make sure to make you know that everyone's going to laugh when they hear this story. This is part of living the good life. And so what I think it's about is not falling into any of these boxes. So not falling into the box of this is happiness or this is happiness, but the flexibility of bouncing around. And that's something that science has yet to get to yet. When we really want to understand people, it's about that we do bounce from, I just want to have incredibly phenomenal, passionate sex today. And then tomorrow, I can't wait to sort of go mentor, little child from the inner city whose parents sort of left them, and I'm going to sort of spend 2 hours just, you know, teaching them their arithmetic. I think the balance between these worlds is really where the action is.
Don't you think some people would say, not necessarily, that there would be less emphasis on gratifying those pure pleasures that we're capable of because we have the good life here? There should be more discipline and maybe a little less self-indulgence?
I think that most people who study in this field would disagree with the last sentence that I had. At the same time, I think that sometimes it's important to be selfish. You know, I spent 5 years in Buffalo working and running a clinic for depressed adults. It's an outpatient clinic. And one of the things that we would teach them is, it's time to be a little bit selfish and devoting some time to yourself. What brings you pleasure? What's going to get your dopamine level up a little bit? What's going to sort of be important to you to focus on, even at the expense of other people, to get out of this sort of funk that's sort of basically like a ghost in the machine that's guiding your life?
You know, when we talk about doing for others or doing for ourselves, there is something about the doing for ourselves that you tell students is called the hedonic treadmill. What does that mean?
The hedonic treadmill is that when we start to obtain benefits over the course of our lives, let's take money is sort of the best way to sort of describe this. Typically, more money will lead you to derive more well-being. That's because you're finally able to start to afford the necessities of life. The more money you obtain, you start to find that you're spending it on expendable goods. You're spending it on leisure. You're spending it on things that aren't necessary. And eventually, if you were to have lobster on a weekly basis, and if you were able to go to on a cruise every month, and if you're able to sort of explore the world and hit Florence 5 or 6 times over a decade, what happens is you start to become potentially a little bit mindless, and you start to lose the benefits of all those positive experiences. It's sort of a tremble. It's that the more that we obtain, the more that we want to obtain. we start to compare ourselves to other people who are now in a higher bracket than us. And so even though we've moved ourselves up a little bit, now we have another goal to obtain that we want to work towards. And we get on this treadmill of constantly trying to consume and obtain and consume and obtain, and we never actually just sit and savor and marinate in the benefits that we have. That's sort of the hedonic treadmill. We adapt very quickly, and then we start to look for other things to get us that high that we had when we first had that positive experience.
Well, Todd Kashtan, thank you so much for sharing this with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you.
Happiness runs, happiness runs in the circular motion. Thought is like a little pot upon the sink. Everybody is a part of everything anyway. You can have everything.
Todd Kashtan is a professor of psychology at George Mason University.
Happiness runs, happiness runs. Happiness runs, happiness runs.
In the 19th century, most Americans grew or made what they needed. But by the turn of the 20th century, an emerging consumer culture promoted constant spending to meet our material needs. Our next guest is Charlie McGovern. He's a professor of American Studies at the College of William & Mary and the author of Sold American, Consumption and Citizenship. He's a former curator of American culture at the Smithsonian Institution. He says early on, advertisers began to define consumption as the foundation of the pursuit of happiness and the American way of life. Charlie, we tend nowadays to think of ourselves as so entrenched in consumerism, it was always this way, but that's not true. What started happening in the late 1800s that precipitated this change?
Americans had always had things, Sarah. There were store-bought things all along in American life. But in the 1880s, the economy industrialized and it became more and more difficult for people to exist outside of a commodity market. You had to get your food, you had to get your shelter, you had to get your clothing, not by making it yourself or growing it yourself, but by purchasing it from others. By the late 1880s, with the growth of national brands, Campbell's soup, Borden's condensed milk, things like this, those things were produced, of course, far away, and you didn't really know who made what was in the can.
Who were the agents of change as we began to become more of a consumer society?
Advertisers, marketers, industrial firms felt the need to convince people to buy more. Advertising agents who had begun their careers in the mid-19th century selling newspaper space, very similar to what Google is trying to do now, eventually became specialists in crafting the messages, the sales messages, for manufacturers, and then placing them in different media, newspapers, magazines, farm papers, the sides of barns and fence posts and things like that. One of the most famous examples was for soap. It showed a man and a woman sitting together, obviously in love, and the advertising slogan was, "For the skin you love to touch." And in that image, you see, you know, desire and sexual attraction projected onto a small, modest commodity in a package.
Highly successful?
Very much so. From the time of the Revolution on, the idea that what made America distinct was not only its devotion to freedom, but the kind of material abundance that expressed God's blessing, that was very heavily associated with a distinctiveness of this nation.
We saw ourselves as possessing a distinctive culture, but didn't Europeans see us as unrefined and backwards and lacking in a rich culture?
By the time of the 20th century, Europeans began to see that what was distinctly American were its new products, its cars, the movies. Hollywood represented America. So products became one of the most important things in making a distinct American culture. And that advertisers, of course, especially pick up on, because advertisers have some of that same concern. These are educated, elite people, and they want to see a distinct American culture. in effect, draping themselves in the flag and pointing out the connections between products and the nation. If you can open up your wallet, that's as good as voting. That was a strategy that they came to. And I want to say this almost naturally. It was already built into the history of American nationalism to associate wealth with American distinctiveness. Example of that, a 1907 ad for Ivory Soap features the Statue of Liberty, and she's holding her torch, and in her left hand, instead of the book that she carries, there's a huge bar of Ivory Soap.
Really?
And yes. and the headline says Soap Enlightenment. The Statue of Liberty was called Liberty Enlightening the World. That was its formal title. And so in that one image, you associate American freedom, learning, progress, cleanliness, of course, and Ivory Soap, the brand. That's the kind of thing that advertisers began to do on a regular basis.
But there came to be a culture of people who sort of stood up to the growing power of the marketers and the ad men. Tell me about them.
In the 1920s, a group of professionals who were very suspicious and disgusted with advertising's excesses began to fight back. Two men, Stuart Chase, an economist, and Fred Schlink, an engineer, co-wrote a book called Your Money's Worth, which appeared in 1927. That book told consumers that advertisers were putting them through a maze of misinformation and deception, and that people in the marketplace were confused and deceived. The book was quite a national hit, and what they really latched onto was the myriad examples in this book of how advertising, in order to sell, promoted waste and inefficiency on the production end and ignorance and greed on the consumer's end. And what these guys were saying in the end was, a breakfast cereal is just that, a breakfast cereal. It's not my identity. Soap is soap. It's not the key to my sex life. These are the kinds of criticisms they were making.
What were the attitudes towards consumers on the part of the advertisers and those who were trying to debunk some of the marketing myths?
As one wag put it in an 1896 ad journal, the masses, we should also call them asses. They are educated professionals. They are talking to people whom they see as being very different, having much less education, much less sophistication, and that is troubling to them. And at the same time, they have to get these nincompoops to buy their stuff. They have to sell goods to people who aren't their cultural equals.
When we talk about how we got into our current consuming climate, another big leap was made, wasn't it, with radio, mass marketing.
Yes. The radio audience was so responsive to the messages, the intimate, in the home, in your ear messages that were produced, that advertisers could scarcely believe their luck in stumbling into this medium. The sales for products went up dramatically over and over. The program Amos and Andy turned Pepsodent from an also-ran brand of toothpaste into a leader. One advertiser said, we were like kids in a candy store.
How did the onset of the Depression change or possibly delay our growth as a consumer culture?
The Depression, because it was a crisis of capitalism, it made it very clear that the country was a consumer economy. By that I mean federal policymakers, in attempting to repair the economy, first focused in the New Deal on the production side, getting manufacturing and agriculture back on its feet. And in the end, it was only if the federal government began to look at purchasing power, only if the consumer's money was going to get them something, could the economy really begin to recover. It also paradoxically, of course, whetted our appetites for things. And again, because radio was established, you still had sponsorship of programs, and the sponsorship, of course, was delivering commercials. Now, the big ticket items, refrigerators, cars, suffered greatly in the Depression. The small items, the everyday items, those companies suffered much less. This, to me, indicates that people were going to consume.